Gabon's military arrests its president.
The Secretary General calls on all actors involved to exercise restraint, engage in an inclusive and meaningful dialogue, and ensure that the rule of law and human rights are fully respected.
Plus, after a court Tuesday suspended the sentence of Pakistan's former prime minister, another court kept him in custody.
The military appears determined to make sure that Khan does not come out of prison because there are more than 170 allegations that have been instituted against Khan since his removal.
And how so-called smart bandages can help those with diabetic wounds. Today is Thursday, August 31st, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Military officers in oil-producing Gabon said that they have seized power on Wednesday and put President Ali Bongo under house arrest. This is after the Central African State's election body announced that he had won a third term. The Gabon junta named General Brice Oligui Nguema as the transitional leader.
Faisant suite à la réunion de ce jour.
Colonel Ulrich Manfumi made the announcement in a video that was released on Wednesday, stating that Nguema was unanimously appointed to the position. Gabon's President Ali Bongo confirmed that the arrest was made in a video that he also released.
And to send a message to all the friends that we have all over the world, to tell them to make noise, for the people here have arrested me, and my family, my son is somewhere, my wife is in another place, and I'm at the residence.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the coup. His spokesperson, Stéphane Dujarric.
The Secretary General calls on all actors involved to exercise restraint, engage in an inclusive and meaningful dialogue, and ensure that the rule of law and human rights are fully respected.
The coup in Gabon is raising concern about the future of countries in the Central African Economic Bloc, CEMAC, which has some of the world's longest-serving leaders. Moki Nwankinzeka reports from the Cameroonian capital to start us off.
Ce jour, 30 août 2023, nous...
Several dozen youths, a majority of them students from the University of Yaoundé, watch attentively as soldiers declare on Gabonese TV that the military, united in a transitional committee, is putting an end to the leadership of President Ali Bongo. The 64-year-old Bongo has ruled Gabon, an oil-producing nation, since succeeding his father, Omar Bongo, who died in 2009 after 42 years in power. Gabon held elections on August 26 with Ali Bongo running for re-election. But contested results indicate 69-year-old Albert Ondo Osa, a former minister and university professor, won the poll. Ondo said Ali Bongo wanted to steal his victory. Anong Jacob is a secondary school teacher in Yaoundé. He says post-election confusion in Gabon has given the military an opportunity to seize power, claiming that they want freedom for civilians, just like the militaries of Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali.
It's a shared feeling with those in Niger who are thinking at the moment that the time is now or never. They have all the resources, gold, diamond, timber, and all of that, but we don't have any of the industries or factories that can process this material. All is transported to the West. We have little or nothing to benefit from it.
Gabon is a member of the Central African Economic and Monetary Community, CEMAC, an economic bloc that has some of the world's longest-serving leaders. 81-year-old President Teodora Obiang-Nguema of Equatorial Guinea won elections for a sixth term in 2022. Obiang came to power in a 1979 military coup and is the world's longest-serving head of state. In the Republic of Congo, 80-year-old Denis Sassou Nguesso has been president for all but five of the last 44 years. And in Cameroon, 90-year-old Paul Biya has been the president for 41 years since 1982. Central African Republic President Faustin Archange Touadéra hasn't been around as long, but recently extended the presidential term from 5 to 7 years and did away with the two-term limit for presidents, the CAR opposition says Touadera created a life presidency for himself. Lange Ngaderik, lecturer at the International Relations Institute of Cameroon, says these leaders' desire to hang on to power is causing systematic problems and widespread frustration.
Something has to be done, especially in French tropical Africa, ex-French colonies particularly, where egoistic interests frustrate most of the youth. You come out from the university, policies do not favor your integration into the system and help your nation, especially in some of these Francophone African countries.
Nga said if the opposition in French-speaking Central African countries remains fragmented and leaders keep their strong grip on power, the trend of militaries taking power, as happened in Gabon Wednesday, may spread even further. Moki Edwin Kinzeka, VOA News.
Hurricane Idalia flooded streets of Florida Wednesday as it slammed into the Big Bend region, where millions of residents had evacuated or hunkered down in anticipation of a dangerous surge of tidal water. It then brought torrential rain and threats of flash flooding Wednesday afternoon to southeast Georgia. Authorities in Florida were still trying to carry out a damage assessment in the hardest-hit areas as water rescues of trapped residents were underway in southern Georgia. The high speed at which Hurricane Idalia intensified before it made landfall in Florida was most likely increased by climate change, says Professor Kevin Reed of Stony Brook University in an interview with Reuters.
So what we're seeing with this storm is similar to what we've seen with the, you know, recent storms, is that as the storm is approaching land, or as it approached land, right, it went over really warm sea surface temperatures, which really aided its growth and intensity.
In Washington, U.S. President Joe Biden said that no one can deny the impact of the climate crisis anymore following Idalia's landfall. He also announced nearly $100 million in funding that's being sent to Hawaii to harden the state's electrical grid following the devastating wildfire that has destroyed one town on the island of Maui. Steve Herman continues our coverage.
President Joe Biden, speaking at the White House on Wednesday, asked for patience from residents of the Hawaiian island of Maui, where an August 8th fire sparked by downed power lines killed at least 115 people and destroyed the historic center of the town of Lahaina. Biden says he has directed his government to work with urgency and focus, but rebuilding the town and the infrastructure is going to take a while.
I directed my team to do everything we can for as long as it takes to help Maui recover, rebuild in a way that respects and honors Hawaiian traditions and cultures and the needs of the local community.
Some Maui residents have expressed frustration with the pace and level of government support following the fires. The chairman of the House Oversight Committee, Republican James Comer, says his committee will investigate the responses of federal, state, and local governments to the disaster, saying they raise serious questions and he wants to ensure accountability. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
A special Pakistani court on Wednesday extended former Prime Minister Imran Khan's jail custody for 2 more weeks. And this is after a federal court on Tuesday suspended Khan's 3-year sentence and ordered his release on bail. I got the details earlier from Ayaz Gul in Islamabad via WhatsApp. So what exactly happened and I guess why?
Well, it's a good question because a military-led crackdown is underway against former Prime Minister Imran Khan's political party and his party leaders. And what has been happening over the past many months is that his party leaders have been arrested, then courts ordered their release, but then they are rearrested. So this pattern now is being applied to Khan's detention. He was sentenced in a controversial ruling by a federal court earlier this month to 3 years in prison, and he was also subsequently banned from holding public office for 5 years because of the conviction in this graft case. But then because so many independent legal experts also identified a lot of flaws in the judgment, it was anticipated when the first hearing happened on Tuesday that this will be overturned. But instead of overturning the conviction, the court said it's going to conduct a new hearing into the case and will make a final determination. So that's when Khan's sentence was suspended. But immediately after the suspension, we saw another directive from the government saying that, by the way, he is required in another case for allegedly leaking official secrets. So that's why he will not be able to leave the prison.
As you mentioned, the previous conviction that stems back from August 5th. For our listeners, can you briefly kind of summarize what the initial case was and go into a little bit more detail about these new allegations?
Well, the initial case was very simple. I mean, in terms of how the government framed it, was that Imran Khan, being the prime minister, when he used to travel to foreign countries for on official visits, he would receive gifts like any other prime minister or leader, be it a military leader in Pakistan. You know, they are given gifts by their hosts. So those gifts Imran Khan brought back, and there is a law which allows the recipient to retain the gift by paying a certain amount of the estimated price of that gift. But what happened in the process that he declared that amount in his annual tax documents, but when he submitted his election document, he claims that his accountant forgot to mention that amount in the election-related documents. But this other case is very serious in nature. I think that's actually the root cause of the entire political tensions that have been prevailing in Pakistan since the dismissal of Imran Khan from office, because that case is related to a diplomatic document, which is internally called a cipher. This is going to be more explosive, this case, in the days to come, because the more they hold these proceedings, the more detail is going to come out of how the United States allegedly played a role in the so-called regime change in Pakistan. I mean, this is what every observer in Pakistan is now fearing, that it's going to create more problems for the bilateral relationship between Pakistan and the United States the more they go ahead with this case. And the military appears determined to make sure that Khan does not come out of prison, because there are more than 170 allegations that have been instituted against Khan since his removal. And, you know, he's been accused of terrorism, sedition, murder, and corruption. So it is going to happen, and we're going to witness in the coming months that if he's released in one case, even temporarily on bail, he's going to be rearrested in another case, because it's 170 cases.
Ayaz Gul reports for us from Islamabad. We're talking to him via WhatsApp. Ayaz, thank you very much for that update. We really do appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
We're also following these stories from around the world. Officials say scores of sea lions have died from bird flu in Argentina as an unprecedented global outbreak continues to infect mammals, raising fears it could spread more easily among humans. Local news reports intensifying clashes between U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces and one of its local affiliates in eastern Syria that have left at least 28 people dead. The violence in the eastern province of Deir al-Zor erupted on Monday after the SDF launched a campaign to target what it called criminal elements. South Korea says North Korea has launched two short-range ballistic missiles toward the North's eastern waters. The launches came hours after the United States flew at least one long-range B-1B bomber to the Korean Peninsula in a show of force. Also, the United States, the United Kingdom, South Korea, and Japan are urging North Korea to halt arms negotiations with Russia following revelations that Russian and North Korean talks on a weapons sale are advancing. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Ukraine launched a wave of drone attacks on Russia early Wednesday, likely Kyiv's most extensive assault on Russian soil since the Russian forces invaded Ukraine 18 months ago. Reporter Anna Chernikova provided this update on VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine podcast with host Steve Karish.
We have confirmation from the Ukrainian intelligence about this attack on the airport in Pskov. And it's also confirmed that at least four transport jets were destroyed in this airbase. Also, it was attack in total. The attack covered four areas in Russia, and all these attacks were done with the use of drone.
Now, ordinarily, the Ukrainian authorities don't say anything after a drone attack on Russian territory. They don't comment. Yet, for this one, they are saying that they destroyed those planes. Why the difference?
Well, I think that this is probably a very successful operation considering the destruction of at least four transport air jets, and probably it was just too successful to hide. This is my, my opinion.
Anna Chernikova is in Kyiv. Anna, as always, thank you for your time today. Thank you for your reporting.
Thank you, Steve.
Meanwhile, Moscow's forces hit Kyiv with drones and missiles during the night, with what Ukrainian officials described as a massive combined attack that killed two people with falling debris. And the Wagner private military contractor says a memorial service for the mercenary boss has taken place behind closed doors. Charles de Ledesma from the Associated Press has that story.
A terse statement on social media reads, "Those who wish to bid their farewell to Wagner chief Yevgeny Prigozhin should go to a cemetery in St. Petersburg, his hometown." It wasn't clear from the statement if Prigozhin had already been buried or it was yet to happen. The Kremlin had said earlier that President Vladimir Putin wasn't planning to attend the funeral. The tight secrecy and confusion surrounding the funeral reflects a dilemma faced by the Kremlin amid swirling speculation that the crash was likely a vendetta for the Wagner chief's mutiny in June. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said that a landmark referendum to change the constitution to recognize the country's indigenous people will be held on October 14th. Phil Mercer brings us that story.
Albanese urges voters to back the referendum.
Vote yes for recognition, vote yes for listening, vote yes for better results. Vote yes is a change for the better that all of us can make together.
Opinion polls suggest most Aboriginal people support constitutional reform, but indicate that many other voters don't at this stage appear to back changing the constitution. Critics insist the Voice to Parliament is a white elitist project that won't tackle discrimination or poverty and will further marginalise Aboriginal people. They also insist the proposal will divide Australians. The No campaign is supported by various groups and has advertisements on TV and radio.
This is a massive change, and it will mean that some Australians are treated differently based on the colour of their skin. I'll be voting no.
Conservative opposition lawmaker Michaelia Cash told reporters that the government's information about the role and power of the Indigenous advisory body was too vague.
We have a long way to go. But every day, more and more Australians, they question, what is the voice actually about? And there is an absolute lack of detail for them.
The Voice to Parliament was recommended after Indigenous leaders met in Central Australia 6 years ago. They signed the Uluru Statement from the Heart, which spoke of their despair at the chronic problems in their communities. First Nations Australians make up about 3% of the population, but they suffer high rates of poverty, ill health, unemployment and imprisonment. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And finally, every 30 seconds, someone in the world has a limb amputated because of a diabetic wound. University researchers in California are developing a smart bandage that they hope will change that grim statistic. Jinia Dulu rounds us out.
Researchers at the California Institute of Technology are developing smart bandages for chronic wounds, says medical engineer Ehsan Sherzai Sani.
Different types of sensors that we implemented in this patch can monitor the different wound status during the healing process. And over time, we can see what's going on in the wound area and try to give those information to healthcare professionals to make the right decision.
Sensors in the patch monitor levels of uric acid, glucose, ammonia, and lactate, as well as the pH and temperature of the wound for any sign of inflammation or bacterial infection. The bandage can also apply a low electrical field to stimulate the healing process, which researchers say has proven effective in testing on mice and rats. Human tests for smart bandages will be done through the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California. USC surgery professor David Armstrong says the technology's implications for amputations due to diabetic wounds is substantial.
And we're dedicated to try to eliminating a preventable amputation over the next generation. And you know, it starts with trying to prevent these wounds from occurring. And if they do occur, try to make them as uncommon and as uncomplicated as possible. And what's really exciting is that these tools that we have now, these intelligent sensors.
Armstrong says the concept of smart bandages has become more practical due to smaller batteries and promising research into powering the patches with solar energy or the movement of the patient. Jenny Adulo for VOA News, Los Angeles.
And until next time, I'm Steve Miller.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Zimbabweans recently went to the polls to elect a new president. Although the Zimbabwe Election Commission announced that incumbent Emmerson Mnangagwa won the election, multiple observation missions have expressed deep concern and stated that the country's electoral process did not meet regional and international standards for credibility. Indeed, the Southern African Development Community and other international electoral observation missions cited problems with transparency, independence, fairness, and credibility at all stages of the electoral process. The United States notes in particular the systemic bias against political opposition during the pre-election period and reports from respected civil society groups that Election Commission officials pressured election observers to sign altered polling station result forms. We call on the Zimbabwe Election Commission to make the disaggregated polling station results publicly available to increase confidence in the result tabulation process, said State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller in a statement. The United States is committed to the people of Zimbabwe and their right to choose their leaders in free and fair elections conducted in a transparent manner. We commend those who sought to exercise their right to vote peacefully, said spokesperson Miller. He went on to strongly condemn the intimidation and disruption of lawful election observers throughout the electoral period. On August 23rd, the Zimbabwean government arrested staff from respected civil society organizations engaged in lawful election observation. These arrests prevented efforts to independently verify the Election Commission's announced results, a fundamental component of democratic processes in the region and around the world. Furthermore, threats directed against members of the Southern African Development Community Electoral Observation Mission are dangerous, says spokesperson Miller. And we call upon the government of Zimbabwe to cease these inflammatory and unacceptable attacks. These actions belie President Mnangagwa's repeated pledges to respect rule of law, transparency, and accountability. The United States is engaging with regional leaders to discuss their efforts to re-engage the Zimbabwean government. There is much at stake for the people of Zimbabwe and the region, said spokesperson Miller. We urge all Zimbabweans to remain peaceful and pursue grievances through established legal channels.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.